Presentation. Here we have Ms. Gilsey Haslam. Then we'll request you to introduce your colleagues, and then thereafter your 10 minutes will start. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, honourable members, for giving this small delegation of deeply patriotic attorneys the opportunity to address you on what we consider to be a terminally ill bill. And I apologize in advance for the inevitable medical analogies which will surface throughout our presentation. Because of the time constraints, I'm not necessarily going to take the committee to paragraph by paragraph in our submissions, which we will take as read. So I'm going to jump straight into page 4, paragraph 2, context. So what we anticipated would happen has indeed happened, in that the focus has largely been on lawyers and lawyers' fees and lawyers wanting to act in self-interest. And I think there's a misconception or a lack of full understanding of the true nature of the problem that users of public health care systems are exposed to. So I thought it might be useful to just use two isolated examples of what actually is happening in our public healthcare system. And I've put this under the heading context because I would urge this committee, when it's considering the implementation of this bill, to bear these kind of examples in mind. So the first example is that of baby L, name was Liema, 20 months old at the time of treatment. He had a sore arm, it was swollen. He went to the Frontier Hospital in the Eastern Cape, was taken by his mother. He actually had a bone infection known as osteitis, which has to be treated immediately with minor surgery and aggressive antibiotics. He was incorrectly treated initially. He was x-rayed, which showed no fracture. Curiously, a plaster cast was then applied, and he was sent home. His mother returned 5 days later because, of course, the pain and issue had actually worsened. The hospital staff then detained him for 5 days. They cut his arm to drain pus, which was completely inhumane and inappropriate. This 20-month-old child was then tied to a window frame for a period of 5 days without respite. As noted in the judgment, the pain that the child may have been going through is unimaginable. It would appear the very wrist he was tied with was the very same area where the problem was. Unsurprisingly, this child was left with a major deformity of the arm, which had to be subsequently rectified post-settlement. I want to draw your attention to the top of page 7 of our submissions, where the Department of Health stance in the Eastern Cape was that the treatment given to this minor child was appropriate in the circumstances. And I trust that you will share my outrage that that was the department's stance. We had to run a full trial on liability in this matter to establish that the treatment was in fact not correct. We also had to run a full trial to establish the amount of damages due to baby Liema, both of which trials could and should have been avoided. I then just want to draw your attention to another random example, baby Y, a neonate. What essentially happened here, and what isn't in the submissions, is that this was a young mother, a teenager, it was her first pregnancy. She reported to a hospital on day one, we'll call it, with pains in the waist area. She was clearly in labor. Despite repeated entreaties to nursing staff over the subsequent 3 full days, that she was in excruciating pain and was not given any meaningful form of treatment, nor was there any significant monitoring of the fetus. In fact, there you have the extract from the judgment and the advice that she repeatedly and impatiently received from the nursing staff, lady walk around, etc. And on the third day, when the pains were indescribable, this uninformed teenager begged for a cesarean section and was met with the response, "You seem to know a lot you're going to deliver your child in the normal way like other people. Eventually, she was so exhausted from pain, she collapsed in front of the maternity theater and was subsequently delivered of baby Y, who unsurprisingly was left with cerebral palsy. I want to draw your attention also to the following conclusion in the judgment. In this matter, where again liability was contested, the care given to the plaintiff was nothing short of substandard. The defendant led no evidence whatsoever. Well before trial, the defendant was possessed of his own expert evidence which indicated that the hospital staff was negligent. Despite this, the trial has been doggedly and unnecessarily proceeded with. I'm accordingly satisfied that this is a matter where a punitive cost order should be made. Now, tragically, these examples that are given are by no means isolated and are in fact quite typical. And in that context, if we sit here before you and budgetary considerations are given preferential status over and above the human rights issues which are at stake here, you won't mind if I say that as a lawyer representing these injured people, I find that deeply offensive. Johan Roo, to my right, is going to address the balance of our core submissions. To my left is Cornelia Quello, who is also a member of our medical malpractice team. She has the added advantage of spending many, many years in the medical fraternity, and inter alia was a senior ICU nurse. Cornelia is also part of one of our pro bono initiatives, whereby she gives lectures on ethics and risk management in medical malpractice to both private and state training nurses. I'll hand over to Johan.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. Many good points have been raised, in my view, thus far, why this bill should not be made an Act of Parliament, and we'd just like to add a few points from our perspective. The first one is going to be a huge conflict of interest that arises in a case where the state is now also involved in the payments afterwards. Like Kirsty said, sometimes these matters are contested. The state says, no, there's no negligence. You're not supposed to get any money. And now suddenly you say, okay, now we're friends. Now we have to work out a plan. How are we going to pay you? So two examples there is, what if there's revolutionary new treatment, for example, that's going to cost like R1 million, and the parents go to the state and say, I want to send my child for this stem cell therapy, for example. That administrator is going to be faced with such a difficult conflict now. Do I pay extra money because I know there's a long queue of other periodic payment clients waiting outside? Or are you just going to say to the child, sorry, we can't send you for that treatment, budget constraints? And also conversely, what if the treatment is absolutely not indicated, but the parents are now asking for it? Isn't the suspicion then going to be that the state is again trying to hurt my child here, even if there's a legitimate reason to refuse it? The second point we make then in our submission is that often we find the parents are very relieved if they find out there's going to be a clean break from the state. You don't have to go back to that same state hospital. You don't have to go sit in that same queue where maybe last time there was a huge delay in treating you or your child. And again, also from the state's perspective, if you are the state and you're again treating that same patient, aren't you going to be doing defensive medicine later? Last time you didn't send the child for an MRI scan, now you send the child for an MRI scan every time. And it's going to cause a lot of problems there. And like I said, our clients are usually very relieved if they find out there's finality. You don't have to go back to that hospital. You or your child are now sorted out in terms of treatment in a private institute. And the third point we make there is the administrative burden. Now, the state system, the state health system is already under a lot of pressure. Now you want to add to that pressure to say now also the same staff must now deal with payments. You know, there's no detail about how it's going to work. You know, we get some hospitals, state hospitals, that have hundreds of claims. Does it mean that all those claims, the payment system is now going to be administered by that same hospital? The risk of corruption, obviously. You know, money being dealt with by the state. How are we going to keep those officials accountable? In most systems that we've got, there's a trust that gets created with the trustee who's got certain fiduciary duties that they have to comply with, and you're absolutely sure the money gets spent. You know, let's say there's a mother with a child with cerebral palsy. Does she have to bring the child to hospital once a year just to show that the child is still alive? And then lastly, we made a submission about the financial burden, and I think the actuary is going to do a presentation later, will demonstrate it, but I think the committee must keep in mind, as we've demonstrated by that very simple example in our submission, that it's just a very short-term solution to do these periodic payments, because eventually it's going to catch up to you where you have to pay every month. At this stage, if you need treatment in future, it's going to cost 100,000 rand. The state only needs to pay you 80,000 now, by way of example. You need to go invest that money to make sure you've got enough. So this is going to be a very short-term solution, but the actuaries will demonstrate that much better than I can. Thank you.
Jeff? Sorry, Chair, is there time for my concluding remark? Thank you. I will do that. Just to pick up on a point previously made, but to endorse it, there is a very clear problem with the wording of Section 2A1 in the removal of a judge's discretion to consider ordering discretionary payments, and this does not compare favorably with international jurisdictions which allow such a discretion. The problem of possibly requiring an injured claimant to return to the self-same hospital where the wrong was perpetrated is simply unimaginable. The retrospective application of this act is also devastating and probably unconstitutional. And briefly in summary, in our view, the introduction of this bill prior to the South African Law Reform Commission completing its extensive investigations into this very issue is premature. The proposed manner of introducing these periodic payments is unworkable. The 1 million rand threshold, which has not yet been addressed, is simply arbitrary. And as indicated, the retrospective application is neither justifiable nor reasonable and most probably unconstitutional. Those are our comments. Thank you.
Chair, that's exactly the one issue I was going to ask about the 1 million rand arbitrary level. So in other words, if your claim is, and again the wording is a bit unclear, but if your claim is settled or judgment for 999,000, you will then get the full amount, but if it's 1 million, then you're subject to this. Surely that is discriminatory as well, considering the arbitrariness of that. Secondly, I want you to just come back to, you are obviously experienced litigants in this area. You litigate against the state. The issue that I keep raising of wasted state costs by litigation, whether it is the state attorney, whether it is the advocates that are being briefed, and I now understand, Chair, and these are issues we've got to investigate. I understand that there are some health departments that now are firing the state attorney at the court steps and appointing private attorneys with no explanation. To me, it is vast corruption that is going on there. Some people are milking the system, and that is resulting in millions of rands that are wasted. Has it been your experience as well? You've given these examples of indefensible cases that are running to full trials, and then there are other cases of appeals, and then judgments are granted, and then to the Constitutional Court almost, and then people wait for payments on that. Even with judgments, the payments are not made and there are incurred legal costs. Surely the time is arising where the courts have already said that public officials must be held personally accountable, whether the minister or even a state attorney. The concept costs de bonis propriis against a court official. I'd like you to comment on that. Again, would you be in agreement that this is a gross violation of women's rights, given the fact that most of these cases relate to obstetrics, and that we are looking for a solution in the wrong area? The solution lies in improving the care for the most vulnerable of society. Those are women, pregnant women, that are facing obstetrics and challenges in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, we welcome the presentation. I think they've raised very important points that we are noting very serious as members of this committee. And I think they went to an extent, I think, of making some example of some of the victims of these challenges that we have in our various health institutions or in hospitals in particular. Well, back to the point of the staggering payment or periodic payment versus once-off payment, I think you are also raising a very good argument. But also, if we look at on the other side of the coin, what if the state pay a complainant a once-off amount, but then that particular complainant misuse that money? It does not invest, like I think you have alluded to, say that person can take the money and invest the money so that to take care of the future medical expenses. What if that person takes the money and use it for something else? Is that person not going to come back again and be the burden of the state after that money is finished? Let's also look at that particular part. Can you, thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we should consider also hearing submissions from the State Attorney with regards to this particular bill as a committee, and the Provincial Health Department, because I don't think we're going to be able to finalise anything without hearing from them about their somewhat lacklustre performance. And then I'd just like you to comment on the fact, if you're willing to, that while this bill is clearly, as it, in its current state, unconstitutional, it's distasteful and somewhat immoral as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If I can go to the Honourable Swart's questions first and start at the end of his question rather than beginning. In summary, this bill is seeking to treat the symptom and not the cause, and that's precisely the problem. And all it's doing is kicking the problem into touch as far as budgets and finance is concerned. As you'll hear from the Actuarial Society later, the problem is going to be greatly compounded from a financial perspective. And at that stage, remember, already you'll have undermined significant human rights. The arbitrariness of the 1 million rand, as the Honourable Swart picked up on, there's been no substantiation as to how that figure was arrived at, how it was deemed to be fair or reasonable. From my perspective, I can only put to you that it's completely inadequate, but we don't have the time to address fully why that is so. And on the issue of wasted state costs, unfortunately, that is also endemic in matters of this nature. Lack of instructions being forthcoming timeously. The examples which I alluded to earlier, where liability was contested, where it was absolutely inexcusable, almost criminally negligent conduct that was in issue. If I can go to the Honourable Skosana's question, and I think you raised a concern about the misuse of funds in terms of the once-off payment. I can only speak to my experience in that we are very diligent as practitioners to ensure that funds are cared for by way of the mechanism of trust or other wise investment, so that that exactly does not arise. I did understand that correctly, Chair. Thank you. Yes. And I think one must be careful of assuming that these kind of practices, such as abuse or misuse or wasting of funds, are commonplace. Because then you run the risk of unduly elevating that kind of problem, and you end up legislating for an uncommon situation as opposed to the common situation, which is that generally funds are well cared for so that they're appropriately utilized. And then just finally, the Honorable Breitenbach, and I would like to, if I may, agree with the Honorable Breitenbach's suggestion for further submissions from the State Attorney and the provincial health departments, because not all of them, I'm aware, have been given the opportunity to comment. Yes, this bill, in my view, is undoubtedly unconstitutional, and it's actually alarming that for a very tiny bill, it's simply besieged with innumerable problems. And I share your concern about its moral fiber, if I can put it in that way. Thank you, Chair.
A small one, Chair. Mr. Skosana asked about the challenge of people being receiving payouts and wasting payouts and then being an incumbent. But what she said, yeah, I think you misunderstood her, because she said trust, and you said no, you're talking about the individual. Just clarity, it's not your trust accounts. You set up trusts for the beneficiary. Please clarify that. Not your trust account, the beneficiary's trust.
Specific client trust account. You are referring to that, isn't it?
No, it's a trust. It's not the trust account. It is a trust that is set up as a separate legal entity.
All right. Okay.
May I respond to that, Chair? I just want to emphasize the point that these trusts that we are referring to, and Johan referred to the fiduciary duties which a trustee has, those trusts operate and the trustees operate under the independent scrutiny of the Master's Office. So it's, if I can use the term, safe as houses. Because if anyone steps out of line, there are going to be dire consequences.
Thank you so much, SC. And thank you, Honourable Members. To follow South African Orthopaedic Association and the Western Cape Provincial Government to follow after orthopaedic. Thank you, sir. You may get to this. Okay. It's lab 7.
Okay. So are we allowed to consult the doctor whilst he's here?
Free of charge, I think so. But you need to declare.
Thank you, Honourable Chair.
How do I address you?
I will introduce myself. I am Dr. Bernstein, Brian Bernstein. I am the second Vice President of the Orthopaedic Association. I'm Chairman of the South African Orthopaedic Trauma Society.
Come closer to...
Is that better? Sorry.
Yes.
I'm Chairman of the South African Orthopaedic Trauma Society. I work in private practice, but I am an honorary lecturer at the University of Cape Town's Department of Orthopaedic Surgery, and I am a practicing orthopaedic surgeon. And I am making representation on behalf of the South African Orthopaedic Association. And who are we? We represent the majority of the orthopaedic surgeons in South Africa, about 70%, maybe a little bit more. We have 860 active members, which include members both in the public and in the private sectors, and trainees in orthopaedic surgery, and our mission statement is that we are committed to the enhancement of access to quality, cost-effective orthopaedic care. I'd like to say that I feel a little bit out of place because we represent men and women, and we represent wealthy and indigent and even the middle class. However, I'd like to start by, our presentation is going to be relatively brief. Our submission is fairly comprehensive and simple. But I'd like to start by just saying a few things about the Orthopaedic Association. When I said that we represent members in state and private hospitals, we have about 170 orthopaedic surgeons, it's estimated, are working solely in the private, in the public sector, of this 800 plus that are our members. However, many of our members in the private sector also work in the public sector pro bono. I'm, as I said myself, I'm involved and will not be recorded as one of these 170. So we do not have an accurate figure as to how many of our members actually work in the state. We know that orthopedic surgery represents one of the higher risks of malpractice litigation, and we therefore have a keen interest in the field of malpractice law, and we are willing to engage with this portfolio committee on this very important matter. We also wish to stress that this massive increase in litigation against medical practitioners and healthcare facilities is not just affecting the public sector, it's affecting also the private sector. And we are supportive of any lasting solutions as those that will have been mooted by the SA Law Reform Commission in its issue paper 33 of May 2017, and I believe that we need to refer to that going forward. So although attempts to address this matter only for the public sector are welcomed, this challenge will continue as South Africa moves into a system of the National Health Insurance where both public and private sectors will be service providers contracted to the NHI fund. I think it's important to understand that, and that is one of our first submissions. To go forward with my presentation on the slideshow, you know, we know that trauma and orthopedic care provisions vary. So you have some hospitals that have wonderful services, and we've already heard this morning that some don't have such wonderful services. At the same time, our patients differ. And I think it's only clear to say that patients with more comorbidities tend to have more complications when they are treated by their attending hospital and or physicians, and I think that those that are affluent enough to access adequate or good health care tend to have less comorbidities. As you've heard this morning, that orthopedics is at a high risk of malpractice litigation, what with obstetrics and gynecology, we as a group contribute 65% of the number of claims against the National Department of Health. So we'd like to say that malpractice litigation impacts the entire healthcare sector. We echo the concerns that training and the provision of logistics support in the hospitals is critical, and that due to this litigation, the issue of defensive medicine is becoming a costly animal to deal with, and it has been raised in the health market inquiry as one of the drivers of healthcare costs. The risks of being regarded negligent by not undertaking specific tests or assessments means that there are sometimes some wasteful assessments done, and something that has been experienced not only in this country. With regards to dual system of protection against malpractice, we're concerned that the introduction of measures to address the impact of malpractice lawsuits in the public sector could result in a system under where patients serviced in the public sector have different, arguably lesser rights than patients in the private sector. Such a system could be constitutionally challenged. So we do not think that this bill addresses this very important issue adequately. Basically this raises the importance of reform, the reform of law across both sectors. With regards to the costs, we know that medical costs outstrip CPI at the moment, and that's likely to continue. We also know that the provision of services at public sector costs, if the patient is going to be treated in the private sector, is also problematic. How will the cost be determined, and how can this be fair if you look at the different base costs of practicing medicine in the private sector versus practicing medicine in the public sector? Also, we've got no clarity as to who will settle the claim for treating the patient or treating a successful claimant. Is this going to be the province? These are questions that need to be answered. So, in our submission, we have made a number of suggestions, which I'm not going to, in the interest of time, I'm not going to necessarily read on. Sorry? 2 minutes. But we'd like to say the following, that we are appreciative of the efforts to reduce the burden on the state in general, and specifically the already overburdened health sector, who, as it's reported, loses as much as 43 billion rand per annum on malpractice claims. And if you take into account that only 35.9 billion is allocated in total to all the academic hospitals for the 2017-2018 financial year, you can see the amount of money that is spent on litigation claims outstrips this. So this eats into the constrained budgets, and we agree that drastic intervention is needed, but we would like to stress not only for the public sector, also for the private sector. We welcome some of the changes in terms of the amendment bill. However, we still believe that we need to look at other ways of capping or limiting compensation in terms of medical liability claims. And the reason that this works for us, honourable members, is that actually we are penalised as physicians merely by the fact that with the increasing claims, so our insurance premiums increase, and you are finding that in certain fields of medicine, specifically obstetrics and spinal surgery, that we are losing, that people are not wanting to go into those fields because of the huge cost of malpractice insurance premiums. So in our mind, capping or reducing medical negligence payouts and claims will have an end effect of reducing our members' insurance premiums at the same time. We also want to say that more and more private healthcare providers and facilities are already contracted to provide healthcare to the public sectors. So we do need to understand that this is across the healthcare environment, not just addressing the public sector. And finally, I'd just like to say at the bottom there, both Professor Dunn, who's the head of department at UCT, and Professor Dutoy, head of department at Tigerberg Orthopedic, are members of our executive committee, and they are prepared to participate. They are both full-time and state employee and are prepared to participate in this commission going forward. Thank you.
Over to you, honourable members. Only clarity-seeking questions, no preamble, no statement, because time is not on our side. Thank you so much. Okay, Honourable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Very briefly, the issue is, I appreciate increase in insurance claims and the premiums, but does the liability or the responsibility not lie with the physician or the nursing staff in the first place to prevent the negligence?
Absolutely.
And I think that is a key point. Secondly, the issue of capping claims is also problematic, because if you're capping a claim, then you might not be able to compensate fully for the consequences of that delictual claim. The third issue relates to the suggestion of that whether you support periodic payments, given the lack of capacity in the state, given the lack of capacity for administration purposes, given the fact that it could in fact result in an escalating costs over the long run. It's a short-term issue to deal with a much broader basis of problems. And the last issue, you correctly point out, or the submission points out, this strange wording of a wrongful claim as opposed to a negligent claim, which is quite helpful. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, so with regards to preventative, sorry,
okay.
Is it?
Oh, by that time, isn't it? By that time, it was only Honorable Swart. Honorable Mpumulana?
Yes, it's good that you get somebody, at least from the department, who will probably sympathize with the state at something. But the problem, I've not seen you addressing much of the problem that is there now of a lot of litigants against the state versus the budget that we have now, which you have correctly admitted that there is that problem. If you could, you were the one, the drafter of the bill that attends to that problem as a lawyer, would you, is what you're saying, does it really cover the problem? Does it sort them up? I've not read all of it, but would you say what is here, I take what is here as your contribution, and that it also addresses the problem that we have? Thank you.
Okay, so if I could start perhaps with the Honourable Member Swartz. So preventative, certainly to try and prevent the negligence, if we're going to call it that, or the complications of any procedure or treatment rests with resources, and I did mention that. We have different resources at different hospitals. I'd like to echo that, in fact, some of our state hospitals have excellent resources and are incredibly well-staffed, but the majority are not, and that's shown out by the fact that they do not hit the targets required. But certainly, we understand that actually first prize, instead of standing at the bottom of the cliff and catching the stones, would be to make sure that the doctors and nurses had the resources and the training to adequately treat the patients so that the complications would be limited or less. And unfortunately, that's a different question. We have no disagreement that would probably be the biggest benefit. But it's not part of this particular, as you yourself said, it's not the Health Commission. They need to address that. Certainly, I'll get back to that when I address the final question. With regards to capping, it may well be very much short-term, and it may very well leave patients perhaps under-resourced. However, the pie is only so big, and we do understand that at the moment people are being compromised by not getting any attention with regards to this, and also we are concerned about losing some of the skills because our colleagues are choosing not to treat or practice in those certain fields. I think it's something that I've never quite understood, but most of the injury on duty patients in this country are treated in the private hospitals, if at all possible, and that's purely based on the resources that are available at the overwhelmed public hospitals. However, that does mean that the private sector is making money from a government fund, which makes no sense. Payment is terrible, though, and very few. I'm one of the few people that actually will see WCA patients, and if I have another complication that's not in my field, to find a colleague to help me look after that patient is sometimes very difficult because they just won't do it, and we worry that that's the same sort of thing that's going to happen with regards to this. The payments being stretched out, we agree, is a short-term solution, but we do see this as perhaps something that will be of assistance to the budgetary constraints at the moment. And I believe that this is all going to change when the National Health Insurance Act is eventually processed. And then, yes, negligence is not wrongful. The definition of wrongfulness is there. With regards to the final question regarding the number, we're just cognizant of the fact that the pie is only so big. We would like it to be bigger, but clearly there are limitations, and we need to work within that ambit, so that's why we're prepared to work with this commission. This particular bill, though, has a number of flaws that we think need to be addressed. However, we are aware of the need to have a amendment of sorts to make this function for all our patients across the board, whether they are in state or private, and whether they are men or women, and whether they are rich or poor, because we're currently in the process of dealing with our own peer review processes, where we will hopefully be able to ascertain that there is adequate provision of care.
Is Western Cape Provincial Department for oral presentation, please. You need to come closer, yes, because you are to follow. Then the last will be Actual Health Society. Thank you so much. Introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair.
You have 10 minutes.
My name is Ronelle Berg. I am a legal advisor with the Western Cape Provincial Government. Beside me is Dr. Anke Nietzsche. The two of us are part of a unit called the Medico-Legal Services Unit that has been in operation for over 2 decades within the Western Cape Province. And our other colleague is another legal advisor, Mrs. Mellum, Michelle Mellum, who is responsible for putting the comments together based on input from the Department of Health and the Provincial Treasury. May I just begin by saying that in the Western Cape, we have a rather unique, fortunate position that we have this specialized unit composed of lawyers and doctors who work together. We have our own budget. So every single matter that comes in, at the stage of a Section 3 notice, a letter of demand, we are able to assess. We're able to get records, we're able to engage with experts, we ascertain immediately whether we're going down on the merits or whether we're going to defend. If we defend, we defend vigorously. If we go down on the merits, we settle. We don't go to court. We have an outstanding relationship with the State Attorney's Office in Cape Town, the head of the State Attorney's Office has allocated to us a dedicated team of state attorneys that work exclusively with medico-legal issues. So that is the perspective from which we're coming from, the perspective from which we're looking at this bill. The vast majority of the cases in terms of value, or the high-value cases that we deal with are birth injury cases where the children are diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Makes up about 30% of the number of cases, but 60% of the value that we face. So with that context, let's begin. We acknowledge that there's a burden placed on the budgets of provincial health departments because of the increase, the startling increase in the number of medico-legal claims. We acknowledge that there is a need to introduce a system of periodic payments. We, however, do not agree that what is proposed in this bill, the mechanism of periodic payments proposed in this bill, is going to provide the answer. In fact, it is our view, and we hope to show you that with examples, that this proposed mechanism is going to have dire consequences, both in terms of practical implementation and in terms of legal implications. And most importantly, the bill just completely ignores the root causes. So let's begin with the first problem that we have, and it's been raised before, so I'm going to pay very little attention to it, and that is the mandatory nature that is attached to Section 2A1, the peremptory prescriptive nature that a court must. Not only taking the discretion away from the judge, you're taking the discretion away from the parties when we enter into settlements. Because now we can only enter into a settlement where we have, the only discretion we have is how often are we going to pay out for the future period, for the future medicals, because that's actually what we're talking about. The big money is in the future medicals. When you deal with CP babies, everything depends on the life expectancy of the child. The longer the child is expected to live, the more you're going to pay out. So you're going to be looking at paying out anything between 15 and 40 years. And that's what you have to budget for. How judges are going to know when exactly a certain item is going to be required for a child in the next 30 years so that you can appropriately bring out an order that in year 25, the second mobility device must be purchased, and in year 33, you're going to need additional caregivers because that's 3 or 4 or 5 years before the life expectancy ends. We don't know. So it raises huge questions for us. The mechanism that we introduced and we developed in 2016 was the Ring Fence Trust. We're still developing it. We use it on a regular basis, particularly in settlements. What are the advantages of a Ring Fence Trust? First of all, the money is used for the purpose for which it is intended. The trust is administered by independent trustees together with a case manager who's not involved in treating the child. Parents, whether it, or the creditor or the guardian of the child, presents invoices to the caregiver, and it is decided then whether those expenses are reasonable. Now, so in other words, we have a guarantee that the money is, that the injured party is not overcompensated or undercompensated. There's a guarantee that the money is protected and preserved so that it's used for the purpose for which it is intended. Where in this bill is that guarantee? Where? What stops somebody from collecting a payment at any time and going straight to Grand West Casino with that? There's nothing in this bill to stop that. What stops a parent collecting a payment for a million rand and deciding, actually, we're going to not buy the what we decided to buy for this child, the more expensive range of speciality mattress or wheelchair. We're actually going to buy a cheaper one, and we're going to use the rest of the money to meet the needs of the rest of the family. Where in this bill are there any guarantees? There's nothing. And that's why it's going to have a huge problem in its implementation, because we're going to waste money. We're going to end up paying twice. You're going to either overcompensate or you're going to undercompensate, and in overcompensating, there's no way to preserve and protect the money. Let's have a look at the cost of the delivery of the service. This is a huge question mark for us. Who's going to make these payments? I mean, the bill is suggesting that it be made at hospital level. We completely reject that. We don't have the capacity at hospital level. There are 3,816 public establishments in this country. If we can tell you now they don't have the capacity. Let's just take this down to a very basic, simple level. You're going to need one person to pay, you're going to need one person to vet the payments, and you're going to need one person to audit. If you have three people that you have to employ at 3,816 institutions, you're looking at approximately 12,000 extra people that are going to have to be employed to implement this system of paying our future periodic payments. And then who do the payments get paid to? Who's assessing whether the payments are used for the purpose for which they are intended? The system is open to abuse. Where's the money coming from that's going to create this mechanism to deliver the service of structured payments? The bill is silent on all of that. Periodic payments equals delayed, deferred debt. If you have a lifespan for 30 years or 40 years, you are deferring your debt for that period of time. So if you'd like to have a look at the very last page of the representations that we prepared for you, there's a graph. It's a very, very simple graph that shows the exponential effect of deferring your debt. The very last page, Madam Chair, the very last page. And this graph was drafted by Dr. Nietzsche. If you have any questions later, you can pose them to her. Essentially, we're not asking you to look at the values on the graph. Just look at the shape of the graph. So the big blue line in the middle is in the unlikely event that the SLA as amended comes in 2019. It looks wonderful, because that's the impression that this bill creates, that immediately the amount of money that's coming out of the provincial revenue coffers is going to drop considerably. In the case of the Western Cape, it will drop from 200 million to 25 million. But actually, this false impression of a more secure financial situation is only sustainable for about 4 years, if you look at the graph. And then the exponential effect kicks in. Why? Because then you start being responsible for past debt. You start being responsible for present debt in terms of these claims, and you are responsible for future debt. And projecting that. I beg your pardon? 2 minutes. Thank you. The implications for prudent fiscal control are also extremely dire, because we don't have legislation that authorizes us to give guarantees for payments that are going to be made over the next 20 or 30 years. We don't have that. But we have a constitutional obligation to comply with a court order. So now you're going to have this friction within provincial health departments. If we commit to paying out a debt for which we cannot give a guarantee, that's potentially unlawful. But if we don't comply with a court order, that's unconstitutional. there are dire consequences there, and there are lots of legal challenges we see coming from that point. Let's have a look at Section 2A in brackets 2C. This is the clause that makes it appear as if provincial health departments can save even more money by allowing patients to have the treatment in public health facilities. Now, if you'll please just go and have a look at the second attachment in our representations. It's after the first piece of green paper. It's entitled Medical Brief. This is an article that appeared in Africa's Medical Media Digest earlier this year, and it comments on the Office of the Health Standards Compliance report that was tabled in Parliament earlier this year regarding the inspection for 2016-2017. Because Section 2A2C says that we can provide treatment, the court can order the treatment can be provided by a public healthcare facility as long as it is compliant. Well, if you read this report, you will find that only 5 out of 696 hospitals and clinics that were inspected were compliant. People have said that means 0.7%. Yes, that's what it means. It also means 99.3% were not compliant. What does that mean for us as a provincial health department? This clause is useless. It doesn't save us a cent because we can't use 99.3% of the facilities. However, if we have a look at the Constitutional Court judgment, that probably was a catalyst in pushing this bill to the point that it is, and that's the next attachment, I have earmarked for you certain paragraphs where Frohnman J has confirmed that there's authority in our common law for the courts to make an order that a public health care facility can provide treatment, future medical treatment, future medical services, as long as there's proof before the court that the service is as good as or better than what is in a private hospital. So we are saying that have a look at, if you are going to insist on going further with this bill, which we think you shouldn't, but if you are going to, have a look at codifying the common law principle. Because there are cases where there are hospitals that have very, very well-functioning departments within them. The hospital itself may not make the 80% mark of the OHSC, but it may have a really good department that can provide a service for a patient or for an injured party for future medical services. I am still left with something. It's very briefly. We're just saying that some of root causes, we are not ashamed to admit that we make mistakes. The root causes are primarily human error and system failure, inextricably linked to lack of resources. Take the resources and plug that into that. Let's get more doctors. Let's get more nurses. Let's make sure that there's training. Let's make sure that there's risk management. There will be less mistakes. There will be less medical claims. Structured medical payments is not going to reduce the number of medical negligence cases. Thank you. Madam Chair, could you just repeat that for me, please?
Earlier on we said, in written responses, we'd like you also to include the last part of fixing the issue of nurses, facilities,
certainly,
and so forth.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Western Cape Provincial Government. Honourable Members, questions? Last seeking questions? Honourable Mlaudzi, Honourable Mbumlana, Honourable Swart, Honourable Breisenbach. Thank you.
I want to ask one thing from the provincial government of Western Cape, and this with your presentation, you can see we make so many research about our public health facilities, that about more than 90%, they are not up to standard. So, with this report on legal point of view. Did you try maybe also to discuss it with your colleagues on the National Department? The people who are advising the ministry at a national level about this presentation, because it's very much clear, it's open, cases from the Constitutional Court. We just want to check, why are they not making sense out of this? Thank you.
Well, the three questions I would probably ask to the government, because I think
I am dealing with the government now.
You have a certain budget, which is limited, which doesn't even cover your normal costs. And all of a sudden you've got a big lump sum of a court litigation you have lost, and then there's a claim. And that claim is more than even or close to your budget, or you make you not obtain the particular service delivery you planned. You have a choice that you have got to sell your beds and your cows and everything. You are attached because you have to pay all that amount at the same time. Your presentation here mainly is saying it will not work in that way, it will not work in that way. What we want from you, even if you don't do it now, is to make a concrete suggestion that, apart from what you're saying here, what I've read some of it because I've just received it now, which is not your fault. But what I see here is mainly to say, this will give a problem, this will give a problem. I don't deny there may be a problem, but now I want you as a government, faced with this problem, all of a sudden South Africans are becoming Americans. They sue, even doctors are scared now to do anything, and nurses are also scared, because everything comes is, and there's a lot of lawyers, I'm sorry, with due respect to my colleagues, who now get into and make sure that they sue the state. These are problems that are there. If you could be happy, even if when you go home, you say this will be the solution, but to say that you have to sort out it's okay to say we'll train the nurses, train the doctors to be more careful and so on. But the truth of the matter is that now here is a problem at the front of you. It's hitting on your budget. And now you have to do something. Now there is water in the house. What do you do? So this is what we need in trying to discuss this matter. We need that suggestion from you. We need a concrete suggestion from those. That will take care of the present problem that is here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And I'm very pleased to hear you commending the State Attorney. I presume that's only the Cape Town
Western
State Attorney.
Yes, Cape Town.
But it is a national department, so we are pleased. And maybe that model, Chair, should be rolled out. The State Attorney is a national department. Why is it one department that seems to be working, one State Attorney, Cape Town, and not the others? So I think this model is very helpful, the way that you are cooperating together. What I'd like to just understand, the development of the common law once and for all rule that you would suggest, and that has been highlighted in the court decision that you've indicated, where you have a possible, and I'm sorry, I'm just trying to understand that you don't support the bill, understandably, but the provision of the development of the common law as a lawyer. I'm just trying to get my head around that, because that's obviously a very important issue. The next issue, obviously, from a financial perspective is going forward the escalation that you highlight very graphically, would that not be in breach of the Public Finance Management Act and the whole budgetary provisions, considering that the Western Cape is a department as well with the departmental treasury? And you can also, I would invite you to supplement this with a submission from your departmental treasury as well on that particular legal aspect of being in breach of the Section 66 of the Public Finance Management Act. And then lastly, the empathy that we as representatives need to have for the vulnerable women that are faced with the situation that has been highlighted by other presenters here. But this cannot just be about the money and the funds. And we need to step up to the plate as public representatives and understand this parliament gives budgets. And why is it that the resources of public health resources are so under-resourced? And if we gave more resources to that, we'd avoid in medico-legal claims. And if there was less corruption, we'd avoid the lack of budgeting that we sit in with. So I agree with many of the presenters that we're dealing with a sickness this side when the symptoms are far deeper. So I welcome this submission, and I'm grateful for the model that you are presenting of an effective dealing with the litigation, because it appears that there is very limited wastage of legal costs, that the matters are settled quickly, judgments are paid, that there isn't that escalation that was referred to by other speakers of 30 million rands wasted. Imagine 30 million rands wasted costs on interests, on punitive costs orders. So that is not your experience here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I'm covered by the Honourable Swa.
Yes, thank you. If I can just respond to the Honourable SWAT committee member's query about the Constitutional Court case that I referred to and the development of a common law. I think I was rushing through it because of time problems. I was actually referring to that as a potential solution to what is clearly not going to work in Section 2, capital A, 2, subsection C, which provides for the court to order that future treatment or care can take place in a public hospital as long as that hospital is compliant with the norms and standards determined by the Office of the Health Standards Compliance. And the article that I then referred to show that actually 99.3% of hospitals are not compliant. However, in the Constitutional Court case, what Frohman J did there was, in having a look at the development of, in the common law, the once and for all rule, he confirmed that there is authority in the common law for the court to order future medical treatment and care in public institutions as if the state can produce evidence that such care is of an equal standard to that in the private sector or of a higher standard to that in the private sector. So what I'm saying is that between this, with respect, useless subsection C, which does not assist the Provincial Department of Health's budget, and Frohman's judgment, if this legislation is going to be improved upon, the drafters must have a look at the common law principle and codify it, because there may well be a hospital that fails the compliance test, but within that hospital there will be a department that can offer a really good service that is of the same standard or of a higher standard than what is offered in the private sector. And so in that way, we can still save money. We can still save money by offering the service, even although the hospital itself may have failed the compliance test. So change the measurement, the measuring tool in the legislation, in the proposed legislation. That was that question. Yes, the other one is we do feel that this exponential effect is going to have huge implications with the financial, with the legislative framework, the financial legislative framework within which we have to work, which includes the PFMA and the constitutional obligation to ensure that you manage your debt in the best interests of the good fiscal management and the interests of the provincial economy. Yes, so the answer to that is absolutely yes. In response to the question as to what we suggest now as a solution, we in the Western Cape don't have a budgetary problem with medico-legal issues. We don't. We don't have it because we have a very solid structure that's been in place for the last two decades. And we have the extremely fortunate position of having capacity. We've invested money in having capacity in lawyers and doctors that manage these matters from the time they come in. We've had numerous consultations with colleagues in other provinces, and it is tragic what happens there. You have a lone legal advisor who's expected to manage hundreds of cases on his or her own, in addition to other things that are coming in, not just medico-legal, and they're sitting with state attorney's offices that are non-functional or working in cahoots with the attorneys. We don't have that. So we have proper budgetary projections, we have budgetary planning, we know exactly what we're dealing with, we settle, we mitigate our damages, we use the trust fund to make sure that the money is intended for the purpose for which it is used, so we are not paying twice for anybody and no injured party is double dipping into our system. And we don't have default judgments. We don't, because we have the capacity. We're not wasting costs on default judgments. We're not wasting costs on rolling over and paying because we're so overwhelmed by the number of cases and we don't know what we're doing with. But the answer to that is resources. You need to build capacity. You need to build a structure within. That's the one part is fixing up the health system. The other part is assisting the provincial health departments and building capacity and expertise within the departments to manage the cases. And that's what we're doing. Dr. Nietzsche will answer the other questions that are more relevant to her discipline.
I think the only question that would be relevant for me is the question whether the National Minister knows about the report. Is that correct? Yeah, sorry. He does. It's been quoted in the media, and I think the article that was referred to was in connection with rollout of the NHI. And the minister was—it was put to the minister that the department had collapsed on the basis of this report, which is an audit by the specific body. They visit a certain number of institutions. Of those institutions visited, the sadness is that sometimes these were the second visits to institutions who had already been given instruction to improve their services. So it was put to the national minister that SA Healthcare, it's not collapsed, it's collapsed. And his reply was, it's distressed. And the subtleties of that are, well, euphemistic is putting it kindly. There are no differences. So we are in a very distressed healthcare system. And I fully agree with the Women's Legal Aid. We need to address the root causes and be honest that we are on the brink of collapse and that we are not merely distressed. So the answer is yes, National knows. National has, just to get back to, obviously the risk management of the root causes is something we must address as well, but also for the BICS practice of setting up medico-legal management units and risk management units, we have got a forum with national and provinces, and we meet on a regular basis. And this point is high on our agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ma'am, I, sorry, I am a bit confused. I thought there's one Department of Health, and that in a particular province, and not necessarily when you are talking and you say we in the Western Cape, they in the other parts of it. I thought it's one department. And I thought that the problems that are there are need to be addressed jointly by people generally. Now, when you say that we in the Western Cape, we do this thing, it's more of a political statement than, you know, because to me, I would say that we are in the Department of Health under Mutualedi. These are the problems that are there in the Department of Health. How do you think it can be solved legally and as well as the Department of Health itself does it? That's what we want to find out. Because on the question of the bill is a question of the problems that are there. And I think that I request that when you make a written submission, you please come up and address, even if it is not within the Western Cape, the problem that needs to be sorted out and say, legally, this is how we do it. Don't have the bill, throw it away for this reason and this reason, or you may say that this is that's the solution. That's what I'm requesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Association, Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The other part I can't even attend to. Okay, thank you so much. You have 10 minutes to present. Are you starting to campaign now? Still too early.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to start our presentation by introducing our big team. I think the size of our team and the imminence of the members demonstrate to you all how seriously we feel about medico-legal problems in our field. My name is Greta Dreyer. I'm the president of SASOG, which is the South African Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Our whole team consists of obstetricians, gynecologists. We are all members of the executive committee of SASOG. Next to me is Dr. Conrad Mashiluani. He also represents the Gynae Management Group. He's a member of SOMLA, Medical Legal Association, and he also represents our Medical Legal Committee. Next to Dr. Mashiluani is Professor Priya Sumapale. She will be doing our presentation. She is the secretary of the society. She's also on the EXCO. She is an eminent academic obstetrician. She's also part of the National Committee for Confidential Inquiry into Maternal Deaths. She's also recently elected onto to represent South Africa onto the International Federation of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, FIBA. And then next to Priya sits Dr. Johannes van Vaart. Now, he is the immediate past president of SASOG. As such, he initiated many initiatives for our society to actually address this problem. He also started the Better Office Management Program, which is our attempt to actually improve medical management in our field. Johannes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor Dreyer. Yes, so what we do is just who we represent. Firstly, we do this under the banner of the South African Society of Anesthesiologists, who represents 1,200 members, and they are intimately involved in each and every surgical procedure done in this country. The second, SASOG, we have 751 members, of which about 70% is from private practice, the rest from academic practice, and then also representing FOSAS, the Federation of South African Surgeons, which represents 14 disciplines in academic and private practice. I'm the president of that society, and we have 6,000 members. So I would hand over now to Professor Priya Somapillay to lead our presentation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen. As mentioned earlier, I'll be presenting the views of the South African Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the South African Society of Anesthesiologists. Both societies are professional bodies dedicated to the furtherment of their disciplines at both clinical and academic levels. And furthermore, we are devoted to the welfare of our members and the patient population we serve. SASOG is committed to the improvement of women's health and women's rights and to the reduction in disparities in healthcare available to women and newborns. Although the interests of our members and patients may seem to be in conflict with the matter at hand, the increase in medical legal claims is not in the interest of the public at large or women as a group, and possibly not even the successful claimants. Frequent and large claims threaten to weaken the health system further and may send maternity services in a downward spiral. SASOG is particularly concerned about the increase in medical legal claims against its members and strongly supports comprehensive law reform. SASOG members have been particularly targeted by the explosion of medical legal claims, as obstetrics is inherently a high-risk profession. The frequency and severity of claims against our members has basically made them uninsurable. Medical insurance cover for our members in private practice is close to R1 million per annum. This is an untenable situation. Our members are leaving obstetrics, and there are many parts of the country where no private obstetric service is available. In 2017, a questionnaire was given to our set of members, and 220 out of 330 respondents indicated that they would stop practicing obstetrics if no changes were forthcoming. This would mean that approximately 140,000 deliveries from the private sector would be referred to the state every year. However, we also firmly believe that appropriate compensation should be granted to parties in cases where definite cases of medical negligence has been identified. In addition, appropriate support, education, and care should be available to all people with disabilities or special needs, whether or not these can be linked to an act of unlawful medical management. Payment of large sums to individuals will further cripple the system and increase disparities in care. I therefore appreciate this opportunity to provide input on the proposed state liability amendment bill. I would like to start on some general comments on the bill. We believe that this legislation seems to be of a nature which only addresses one component, namely the fiscal liability. The medical legal problem facing our country must be dealt with in a more holistic approach, and this will require sector-wide law reform. Firstly, there should be a drive to prevent medical negligence. The process of mediation or dispute resolution should be formalized and given more prominence. The advantages of this is that it does away with legal costs, which are currently a huge driver in the litigation process, a huge cost driver in the litigation process. There should be also some guidance regarding contingency fee payments. Currently, many cases are poorly managed because of bureaucratic bungling. Consideration should be given to the establishment of specialized courts dealing in medical legal matters. This concept has been successful in certain areas of the legal fraternity, for example, the formation of specialized criminal and children's courts. As stated previously, the State Liability Amendment Act only addresses financial liability. What about other liabilities? Following the fatal outcome of a case, the criminal liability of doctors and healthcare workers is of concern. The complexity of repetitive legal action must be addressed. We are also committed to the principle of a single special tribunal with a selected panel of experts, rather than the current system of inquest, criminal prosecution, civil case, and HPCSA inquest, each with multiple, separate, and opposing experts. This process should be inquisitorial rather than adversarial. To this end, SASOG has already formed an expert opinion panel of trained experts to assist all parties including state, private practice, and attorneys. A similar process is currently underway internationally under the administration of the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, FIGO. Malpractice claims are currently paid from general health care budgets. Every effort must be made to ensure that funds allocated to medical negligence claims do not negatively impact on health service delivery. A separate budget should be ring-fenced for this purpose. The State Liability Amendment Bill currently only addresses lawsuits against service providers in the public sector. This is a matter of concern because it means that that a patient who has a claim in the public sector will be afforded remedies in the law that is different and possibly inferior to a person who has a similar claim in the private sector. We therefore believe that the whole field of malpractice law should be revisited and there should be no disparity between public and private sectors. I would like to go on to a few suggested amendments to the bill, and I'll start with periodic payments proposed by the amendment bill, and this is section 2A1. SASOC supports the amendment to have periodic payments which may not be less often than once a year. One-off allocations may be misused or inefficiently spent by recipients, or perhaps not even utilized for future medical treatment. We also recommend that lump sum or once-off payments should remain the norm for past expenses. We do, however, believe that the bill needs to be more specific. Legislation does not address fatal outcome cases and the financial burden on the family. Provisions should be made in cases where dependents are compromised by an untimely death due to medical negligence. The specifics on how the quantum payout will be managed downstream should also be clarified. The phrase, on such terms as the court considers necessary in section 282, should be clarified further. There should be a need or yearly review of payouts in place. Consideration should also be given to the fact that costs of medical devices and other imported goods may increase beyond the CPI. Compensation for future medical treatment. Wrongful life, wrongful birth, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and birth defects are the most common reasons for obstetric medical liability claims. However, maternal deaths and surgical complications also contribute to these claims. Section 2D states, the liability of the state shall be limited to the potential costs that would be incurred if such care was provided in a public health establishment. SASOG agrees that if the failed treatment was provided, has occurred in a public hospital, then the right to compensation should be based on treatment at a similar competently run institution. There is, however, considerable variation in the standard of care at different levels at state institutions. There is also variation between provinces. A model of care needs to be developed for the most common disabilities claimed for. This will ensure standardization of care and equal opportunity for victims of medical negligence. In fact, the care rendered in such a model should be of such a quality that it is also the chosen model for victims of failed care in the private sector. Disparities in care is not supported by our professional bodies. To conclude, I'll just like to say that some of the fundamental causes of the escalating medical malpractice claims are changes in the legal landscape, the growth in the contingency fee litigation, and larger awards made by the courts. This challenge must be tackled through sector-wide law reform. The current public health care system is overburdened and under severe budget constraints, and drastic action needs to be undertaken to curb this onslaught. SASOC supports the reform of medical management and clinical governance and have instituted programs such as the Better Ops program and morbidity and mortality review meetings to show our commitment. SASOC therefore appreciates the effort and changes in terms of the amendment bill. We trust that this bill will be improved and comprehensive law reform will follow to address the serious threat. Thank you.
Rana, Honorable Swar. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your honesty because you are the ones that are being sued. And you say, okay, sue us. Thank you very much. I appreciate your contribution, and I think we'll look into that because it tries to solve the problem. And I also appreciate the question that you say there must be equal treatment for negligence in the public as well as private. And I don't know how it will be done, but the drafters will think about it and also consider what are the things that are there. I thank you very much. I think you come up, though you, as I suppose you're not lawyers, you probably would not be able to say such and so and so would be changed in that way. Thank you very much. That's all.
No, I also want to thank you for the submission, and due to time constraints, just to ask you, the changes you referred in the last paragraph, changes in the legal landscape that have seen an escalation, what exactly changes in the legal landscape? I understand changes in the medical landscape that have resulted in increased claims. And then you also make the point that with the NHI being introduced, that we'll see an escalation of claims. What motivates that decision? Thank you. Or conclusion? Thank you.
May I just start by saying that we would like to answer questions on the written submission which was made by SASA in writing, and your very last question refers to that. So we would request that we answer that question in writing.
I didn't get you clearly. Okay. It's referring to. All right.
I think what we've seen, thank you very much for the question, what we've seen in the medical legal landscape is the quantum of the claims have really gone up significantly from 30 million to some cases of 80 million because of future treatments that are patent and not really proven. Now, one of the inherent problems of that is that some of the medical, or we like to call them hired guns, that are really brought into courts are people that are not really experts in their fields, and that's why the motion we had of our expert opinion panel, where people are really experts, will testify. Any specialist is not necessarily an expert in all fields. And I think that's a big problem that we have with the medical legal system, and future care is anticipated, and then what happens, the claims blow up significantly. And we have a big problem with that. In terms of one fact that I think we need to stress is that cerebral palsy is the biggest driver. There are not a lot of cerebral palsy cases, but we must remember that 85% of all cerebral palsy cases are not because of medical negligence, because of patient behavior, and we are held responsible for each and every cerebral palsy case, and I think that lacks evidence. So part of our thing is that we want to make people aware that not all of that is negligent and very often done to poor note-keeping on our side, which we are trying to improve as part of our Better Ops program in all sectors.
Thank you. Any other response? Thank you.
May I add that listening to many of the submissions this morning, I was quite shocked at how extremely simplifying many of these arguments were. I think it is an extreme simplification to suggest that poor medical care and worsening medical care and poor medical care in the public sector only is the sole and main driver of medical legal claims. I think that would not explain what is happening with private sector obstetrics medical legal claims, which have gone up similarly, and where we did not see a massive change in the quality of care. So I think that our submission that changes in the medical, legal, and legal landscape is partly to blame for this, is also to point out this disparity. I think it's from a medical point of view, and we are all obstetricians, gynecologists, experts in that field. We have not seen a massive change in the level of treatment, but yet there has been a very large change in the litigation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Dr.
Yes. I'd just like to reiterate what Professor Trey is saying, is that what we're going through in South Africa has been a problem throughout the world. We are not unique in what we're experiencing. And no emphasis on better treatment in anywhere in the world has cut down litigation. What has helped in most countries in the world is medical-legal reform. The UK has gone through similar problems. They've had legal reforms. And the structured payments is actually used in the national health system in the United Kingdom. And if we don't know how to apply it, we should actually learn from their experiences and actually apply them in South Africa. And the other problem is that because our legal system basically is structured in a way that it doesn't discourage people from taking a doctor to court. There is no pre-litigation process that prevents vexatious claims. In the United Kingdom, they've got a dispute resolution forum where cases are heard and all the facts are laid on the table before any matter goes to court. Only 4% of cases in the United Kingdom actually end up in court. New Zealand, Australia, many parts of the world have had these problems, and they've had successful legal reform. And I think we are at a point where we have to decide how we approach this thing, but medical legal reform is the only way to look at this. And we are saying, we're not here to talk about that, yes, doctors do make mistakes, complications happen. We're not here to talk about that. We are saying, how do we compensate patients in a sustainable way that doesn't collapse the whole system? We are talking about compensation. We're not here to talk about treatment. How do we compensate our patients so that our systems are maintained in the future? And the only way is to use our resources in a sustainable way.
I think we'll assist this committee. Please, you are given 7 days. That's very valuable, what you have just said. Then put it in writing, please, and forward to this committee within 7 days. Thank you so much for the presentation. The last presenters, honorable members and our guests, is Actuarial Society of South Africa. Yes. Will be the last before we break for lunch and preparing for plenary. You are most welcome. Oh, is it on here? Yes.
All right. Okay, I'm Lusani Mulaudzi, the president-elect of the Actuarial Society of South Africa. My colleague, Greg Whitaker, and he's a member.
Thank you so much.
It's the first time I meet him, but I've seen him on TV. on my right here, my colleague Greg Whitaker is a member of the Damages Committee of the Actuarial Society of South Africa. An experienced actuary working in this area, and he assisted the life as a demainee process with quantifying the claims that were paid out, and he did that pro bono. So we want to state upfront that...
Interrupt you. Because the public has got an interest in this, maybe if you talk in this terms, like pro bono, you know, they keep on asking there, what is pro bono, yeah? We understand the committee. Just, you see, thank you.
Okay. I just wanted to highlight what a great South African he is. He did that work to assist the work of that committee. The Actuarial Society of South Africa is very serious about the public interest. We are not just an organization that represents actuaries in the work that they do, but other than training them and being with our vision to be to give authoritative advice and thought leadership in the understanding and modeling and management of risk, financial risk and any other measurable risk One of the most important pillars of that is the public interest. That means the people that are not in this room, but which all of us here can claim that we represent. So the HRO Society also is in that space as well. In terms of this issue, it is a big problem, and I think the what we have before us is almost one can describe as a stopgap solution, which my colleague will highlight some of the challenges with that, aspects that we perhaps agree with, and aspects that are problematic for us. I think we would be expected that there were a lot of statistics that were used and mentioned in this room, and those will be drawn from various places. One of the main things that we bring to the table is the analysis of such statistics, analysis of the data. And there is a lack of data in terms of what is available publicly. The figures that would be quoted normally about the liabilities in the various departments, those underrepresent the problem. They don't present what is actually got there. We don't know how many claims are there sitting in the offices of the state attorneys across the country. There needs to be work to understand that. I think we need to highlight that problem, and my colleague will focus on that. The issue of the structured payments versus lump sum payments, he will focus and highlight some of the challenges from a risk perspective, from a financial risk perspective. He will focus on that. And the last point is that, as we've stated, that it's not only about the data analysis or the modeling of that, but also the management of the risk. And as we've heard from the presentation made by the Western Cape presenters here, that risk management is one of the main things, a pillar in managing this crisis. And it is one of those skills that the actuaries can also bring to the table, and would like that to be part of the discussion as we have these discussions. We agree with the sector-wide approach, and we are taking part in such as and when the opportunities are granted. And we are available to be invited by committees, by government, by the state, to make whatever input we can to help resolve this problem, because it's a problem that affects all of us. I will hand over to my colleague. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I just want to start with, I'm just going to really look at, focus on two slides. The first thing is, do we know the size of the problem? So if we look at the contingent liabilities from 2014-2015, I've graphed it there up till 2016-2017, you can see that the contingent liability has almost doubled over those 2 years. The bulk of it comes from three provinces, Gauteng, Eastern Cape, and KZN. The first problem that we have is, well, what is the contingent liability that's actually been represented? And that's merely the value of the summons. And that what needs to happen is that needs to actually be related to the final settlement value. So I don't think we actually have a real handle on what the problem is, because all we know is that this is what's been summoned, and more than that, there's no linkage. So we need data to actually understand what are we actually talking about in terms of the size of the liability. An example of that is in the Western Cape, the contingent liability that they reflected in the 2015-2016 financials, they had 182 million rand as a contingent liability. That went down by 150 million to 32 million in the 2016-2017 financial year. And during that year, I think around about 38 million in payments were made. So the contingent liability actually reduced substantially. So point one is, I don't think we know the size of the problem. We don't have that data. Moving on onto the issue of what we're really talking about here, is comparing a lump sum to a structured settlement. If you look at this graph that I've put together, this is what we're comparing. So in the normal course of events, as things stand, if a lump sum is made, in this example I'm looking at somebody who needs a caregiver at 20,000 rand a month, and the life expectancy that is settled on is 20 years, so an actuary would calculate a capitalized value of about 3.6 million rand. So what we're comparing in the very first year here is a outflow of either paying 3.6 million or we're just going to pay 240,000 rand as a structure as the first instalment, so as to cater for the caregiver. So the green line is what would ordinarily be paid as a lump sum, versus the very first blue bar, which is 240,000 rand. Now, as we move through time, we look at the cumulative cost of these blue bars. So basically, if we go 10 years into this person's life expectancy, remember the lump sum is calculated on the basis of a life expectancy of 20 years. So if they survive for another 10 years, the actual amount that would have been paid out at that stage gets near to the size of the green bar. As you move on, if you get to, I've just looked at a point after 12 years, you're looking at having actually paid cumulatively, if the person has survived that long, four and a half million rand in relation to what the lump sum would have cost. So I think it's very important to draw the distinction between a discounted value, which is exists under a lump sum regime, versus an undiscounted value under a periodic payments regime. As is always the case in these sort of matters, if somebody, for example, let's say the person had an argument is often raised, if they had received a lump sum of 3.6 million and then they die 2 years later, the argument is, well, you would have paid a lot more than what you should have paid. The converse of that is if, for example, if this person survived 25 years, you can see how much would have been paid out in relation to what you would have paid as a lump sum. I think a very good measure, and that's certainly something that has happened in Western Cape matters, the ring fencing and the money going back to the state. I think that's something that works, and that's something certainly that should probably be looked at throughout the country. Just some immediate fixes. I think something that's not brought up too often, and certainly the impacts on the merits of the claims, is just something called placental pathology, where you actually study you do a pathological study of the placenta, and that can often point to things that have occurred prior to birth. So it's not always necessarily a act of medical negligence or negligence on behalf of hospital staff that's actually caused the damage, but in the absence of any other evidence, it can often be blamed for it. So I think it's a vitally important thing to do to mitigate certainly against the frequency of claims.
The point that we must make is that even if it's delayed, the payment thereof is delayed, what we see is that there will be immediate relief. I think there are other presenters that highlighted that fact, but then there is an increasing funnel of risk as we move forward. And that is something that one needs to. So, as an actuary, what I would do is actually try to quantify. If I had to account for everything today, what is the damage? And then that puts us almost in a similar situation or worse. And so that is the problem structurally that we have with the current bill as it is. But we do understand the need to relieve the cash flow situation. It's just that I think the tool that we have in front of us is perhaps blunt in terms of meeting that objective. Would not meet it very well. But there are many other things that I think I couldn't have said it better than the sort of on the line experience that the Western Cape Department has in dealing with these matters within the department. And those are some of the things that we would recommend. There is a lot of data studies, modeling that needs to be done. And as we've indicated, we would avail ourselves to assist with some of these initiatives. Thank you.
Thank you. as a tourist, you probably know that the last pillar there may be equal to, in terms of money, to the first pillar, which is green, because there is of the change in the value of money. You probably would know that, wouldn't you? So, though it is so many rands, but that is the problem that we have. Certainly, you are probably would agree that if you have to pay cash for your house, you'll probably be able to spread it over the years. It will be better way of doing it. Rather than I pay 1 million rand for the house, and I can pay 3 million, but over so many years, and that 3 million may be sort my financial problems at the moment. I hope you would agree with me in that as well. And I think this spreading is trying to address that, because then at the same, if you would agree with me, you would also that if you the at the moment I understand that there is a model perhaps in the Western Cape. I have not looked at it, but that model is mainly for the that may be looked at. I don't know, but I have not looked at it. But I still say that as far as the bill is concerned, it is exactly time to do what you say is correct as far as spreading out your expenses. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you, and thank you for your conclusions, where you make it very clear that while the intention is to ease cash flows, now the liability remains, and that is what is on your graph escalates. Now, maybe you could just give us the on your scenarios, the figures, maybe if you could using that 240,000 rand with the green bar, is that possible in a later document, maybe, if I understand it, so we can see graphically what it actually amounts at the end of the day on a rough scenario. But I would also like to indicate here that you make it very clear that the issue of a structured payment as opposed to a lump sum payment does not accommodate the issues of contributory negligence, where you have on the merits. That would be you make that very strong point. You also say the state's liability is significantly more variable over that graph, and this would increase the uncertainty affecting the state's financial position and has implications for its credit rating and, of course, its budget. And we've heard the arguments on the Public Finance Management Act, the whole budgeting process. It is unclear how the unfunded liability will be accounted for by Treasury. So thank you for your submission, if you're able to. But I do understand the submission. If it's not possible to give the actual figures, but you can see the escalation. Now, if I'm buying a house, I would rather pay 1 million rand now than over 20 years end up paying 10 million rand. So that is, if you've got the 1 million, but the key thing is the escalation and the debt burden increases over time. Thank you, Chair.
My colleague will handle especially the second question. On the first question, I think there is an issue of trust deficit that exists between the public and the state. In the case of the example that you gave of the house, there is trust between the customers and the banks. There are contracts. It's very clear, and it can be illustrated to you what you can expect to pay, and then people happily go into that contract. In this case, you can sense from the people giving the input here that there is a trust deficit, because certainly the bill doesn't do justice to the trust that could be given, because it's unclear in many ways. So that is the problem that we sit with, that the bill does not give the public, at least those that are in the know, a sense of comfort that the issues will be dealt, and especially the fact that the commitment to deal with the root issues is not evident. So in the absence of that, it's difficult to say we commit, this is great, let's continue with it. Because what problem are we dealing? We're just pushing the problem, and we'll come across it, and it may be even bigger when we come across it. So that is the problem.
Follow up. Okay. I beg your.
Do you want to deal with? You ask the question about how much. I'm going to respond to the second part now. Yeah, I mean, I can give you those numbers in a written document. But you want to know what would the 240,000 rand be worth at each point in time? Just roughly, yeah. Well, look, the blue bars give the cumulative cost, which is escalating.
You know, thank you very much. I just want to say I'm trying, strictly speaking, to come to terms with that. But the trust you're talking about, which I quite appreciate. But I think that in God we believe, and perhaps this cannot be put in the bill, unfortunately. It's either that we look at other ways of doing it. See, what you're talking about is very good, I think, in terms of addressing the health problems and solutions. But this one, strictly speaking, is a question of, at the moment, we have how much do we have money to pay for this now, or we have the state assets attached, and so on. It's a bit dicey. Thank you very much.
If it's possible.
The furniture should get attached today or attached tomorrow. We understand that there is a problem. There is a problem. And I think it will take a lot to solve the problem. I think that's all I can say. What I can say, and perhaps the powers that you have as a committee, is that the offers that we are making here to be engaged on, I think the structuring, because there are countries that are doing structured payments, big countries, UK, Canada, in whatever format. There are ways of dealing with this. Perhaps that needs to be looked into. There are ways, so we need to just look at how best this kind of thing needs to be done. So the message from the Actuarial Society is not that structured payments are a no-no. We're just saying that the bill, the way it's structured, does not give comfort to us to sort of quantify the impact. And perhaps there is a wish to look at alternative models.
Whatever is remaining, especially that question of a statistical in nature, then you will respond everything and also add other information which may be valuable to us. And then, honorable members, thank you so much for your time and for your contribution. You did wonders. 10 presentations within record time. It's now, we went overboard by about 6 minutes. And thank you so much, our presenters. You can just join us for lunch after this. On